Chefs at Johnson & Wales and in thousands of restaurants around the globe will tell you that the hottest name in hand-forged Japanese-style knives at an affordable price is Forged Table. The company, founded in 2017 by Johnson & Wales alum Noah Rosen when he was still a student, is dedicated to the pursuit of the perfect knife for culinary students, working chefs, and home cooks alike. His guiding motto was, and is, uncompromising quality at a fair price. Though Noah is no longer a student, he's still dedicated to that same pursuit. His flagship blade, the 8-inch Gyoto chef's knife, has developed a cult following among kitchen professionals across the country. In addition to the knives, they also have fantastic plating spoons. I use them every day when cooking and serving dinner for my family. I specifically love the spade because it has a little bit of a flat edge on it, and it's great for scraping fond off the bottom of a pan to truly enhance flavor. You can order any Forged Table knife or gear, whichever model from their spectrum of choices suits your kitchen needs right now at ForgedTable.com. Culinary Now listeners can enter the code CULINARYNOW, all one word, with their order at checkout to receive 15% off their purchase. You can also find Forged Table gear at the Johnson & Wales Providence Student Store, but the discount does not apply there, so shop online. Be sure to follow Forged Table at Forged Table on Instagram for great recipes from their test kitchen and to keep yourself in the loop on exciting new knives and kitchen gear giveaways. Forged Table is proud to support the development of new and aspiring cooks and to chefs everywhere to join in the effort to create a better industry for us all. Thanks, Forged Table, for sponsoring this podcast. Welcome, everyone, to the Culinary Now podcast. My name is Matt Britt, and I'm here today with another very special guest, Katie Button, who's the chef owner of Curate and La Bodega in Asheville, North Carolina. Thank you so much for taking some time to sit down with me today.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So being here, I just want to take a little bit of time to acknowledge, like, why are you at Johnson & Wales right now?
I am here for an incredible speaker series. I got to speak to the students today about my story and path, unconventional path from science into cooking, and then kind of what I see for the future of our business and the industry.
So let's go back a little bit to the story, because people that know you as a chef. They know your history, some of your connections, which are, we can talk about in a second, which are outstanding and just like icons in food. But you weren't trained as a chef. Like, how did you end up owning multiple restaurants, being on TV, writing cookbooks? Like, how did you get here? It's not the most conventional path.
No, it is not. I studied chemical engineering in school, and I have an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering and a master's degree in biomedical engineering. And it took me until I was about to start a PhD in neuroscience to finally realize that I was miserable in what I was studying and to think about what I was truly passionate about. My mother ran a catering business out of my childhood home growing up, so food and cooking was just a part of my life. It was the thing I loved and was passionate and just enjoyed and filled me. But I couldn't see cooking at the time as the career path that I was looking for. And it took me kind of going through that moment of crisis of realizing if I started a PhD program, that was committing myself what felt like the rest of my life in something that I wasn't enjoying, to drop out and start working in restaurants. And, you know, the minute that I made that change, it felt like doors started opening, like opportunities just found me. And the first biggest one was that the first restaurant to give me a job was one of Jose Andres's restaurants. And that really was fate. I mean, it sealed my fate in Spanish cooking, in my love of Spain, my eventual travels to Spain, working at one of the best restaurants in the world, El Bulli, with Fran Adrià, and then opening my first restaurant in Asheville, North Carolina, Curate, a Spanish tapas restaurant.
So small names just dropped, which is I have to admit, you know, you and I share a DC connection. We were both there at the same time. You worked at Mini Bar, and I worked also in DC. We could have a whole nother podcast about why DC is a special place for food, but how do you, because I mean, both Fernan and Jose, I mean, they're rooted in this. Well, some of Jose has multiple ventures, but Minibar especially was rooted in the sort of molecular, like sort of, it was new at the time, and so was Fernand. Do you think your science background kind of gave you an unfair advantage over some of the people that were just like, you know, slugging away at the stove?
Absolutely. First and foremost, I think they looked at my resume of, you know, significant science and lab experience and saw that as potential. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's why I, you know, was able to work in the kitchen at OBUI. Like, I think it was that uniqueness and the fact that I was comfortable. While I wasn't, it was so funny, when I started in restaurants, I was not comfortable at the time. I didn't have professional cooking skills. So, you know, I was like trying to learn things like how to cook an omelet, right? Like that stuff was the things I was struggling to learn, but, or not struggling, but like pushing myself to learn. But using a gram scale or liquid nitrogen or, you know, following these like what read like lab procedures and protocols were easy to me. In fact, I was more comfortable with them. I would throw gloves on and dig into that liquid nitrogen all day without fear because I'd been working with it. And so that was a bit of an advantage. It also was my entry point into professional cooking because I was able to take this thing that I had studied and had experience with and all of a sudden merge it in the food world.
This podcast is sponsored by Azaluna Foods. Azaluna Foods is a regenerative food company that focuses on healthy, nutritious, and sustainably sourced ready-to-eat meals. Their signature bone broth is one of the top sellers and favorites of us on the podcast. They also have ready-to-eat foods developed by chefs and nutritionists that provide convenience and nutrition with a balance of macro and micronutrients. These meals prioritize artisanal flavors using responsibly sourced ingredients. Check them out at azalunafoods.com. As far as entry points go, not too shabby. I mean, being in Spain with Fernand, I mean, those are like, that list is few. Let's flash forward a little bit. You're sort of after that restaurant, you're coming back to the States, you're looking to do your own thing. How was the period after, like coming down from essentially like the top? Was it a soft landing or was it like kind of a culture shock as far as like, oh my God, what do I do now?
It was incredibly stressful. You know, I think the one, realizing that if I was going to open a restaurant, if we were going to open a restaurant, we needed it to be kind of everyday Spanish food. So I needed to get away from the molecular gastronomy and move into croquetas and patatas bravas and tortilla española and, you know, the things that I had been enjoying and learning from the culture and community around, but not necessarily in the restaurant that I was working at. And so that was intimidating and an interesting switch, but ultimately really fulfilling.
So you mentioned something when you were presenting earlier to the students about how, like, those pillars, like Fernand, and those are the innovators, those are the people, and that, you know, we should all strive for that, but it's okay to not fill those shoes. I think that's incredibly humble because I think anyone who looks at your career would say that you're also making a massive impact on the industry. You're a mentor, you're a coach to so many young cooks and restaurateurs. Talk about that a little bit more. Like, what did you mean by that as far as it's okay not to be that person?
Yeah, I think, you know, Fran always would say that like the most incredible thing is to create something totally brand new in food that never existed before. And he did that over and over again. He is an inventor. I am more of like the process that even the science community is built on, where you take the work that's been laid out before you by others and you build from there, right? So for me, it's like, instead of, I'm not inventing croquetas, you know, I'm just trying to take my experience and understanding and create the very best version of that particular dish that I possibly can.
And doing it on a consistent basis.
Yes.
And it's one of the, so we embed this, or we try to tattoo this on all of our students, is that consistency is as important as creativity. Like being able to do the same thing over and over again. I mentioned we both worked in DC, and when you find a restaurant, like, and then there was a couple in DC that would just be okay, but every time you went there, it was the same level of okay. And that's the restaurant you want to go to day in and day out, spend money and money and money, and you go back to you because you know you're going to get an enjoyable experience every time. We can't all dine at these, like, you know, destination restaurants anytime we want. So it's good to have people like yourself that are taking up the mantle, that are doing fantastic food consistently and in an approachable way. It's not intimidating. It's not pretentious. It's just good cooking.
I think that's super important and one of the pillars of success, you know, in the restaurant industry is having a clear and concise concept and then delivering it on a consistent basis. If you are constantly reinventing what you're doing, people don't know your story. They lose, you know, what the point is of the food. Then they can't tell the next person why they should go visit you. So I do think that, you know, restaurants, I think a portion of the menu people need to be able to go back and have their favorites and enjoy it. And that favorite that they had from the previous time has to be prepared exactly the same way, which means that the systems on the back end, the protocols, the recipes, the training.
Dialed in, yeah.
Yes, so that it is delivered the same way every time. And honestly, those were the backbones of the success of the restaurant experiences I had, both working for Jose Andres and at El Bulli with Fran Adrià. Fran Adrià was the creator, the inventor. But the people in the kitchen, myself, we were just learning and then creating what they had put out, following their protocols on a precise, consistent basis. And it taught me how important it is to take the guesswork out of cooking for the chefs and cooks in the restaurant space. Like, they need to know exactly how to make something so that it gets made the same way every single time.
I mean, every successful chef, I mean, probably at some level has had an ability to motivate and create culture in their restaurant. And we all know there has been times where culture has not been super positive, but it still has gotten a result. I think what you're describing is these true innovators and visionaries having a team behind them that can help execute their vision. Mm-hmm. That doesn't come without sacrifice. And one of the stories I love that you share is, you know, the polishing of the rocks in Spain, and sort of, it was like a rite of passage, you know, and I don't want to, like, you know, hazing is bad, but, like, at some point, how did that activity, or could you describe that and how that sort of kind of tested your ability to sustain?
Yes. And I will say it didn't feel like hazing, you know, because you're right, like, that is not appropriate. But basically the very first task when the season was beginning at El Bulli, and there were a bunch, like 50 cooks we were all coming there to learn to work at this incredible restaurant. But it was our first time working there. It was our first time preparing the menu. And to get ready for the season, the first task they have is they had us go in the garden and pick up the rocks in the garden, clean them, and put them back. And, you know, it can feel like a moment of, oh, that's not my job. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to cook. I'm not here to be in the garden. But you're there to deliver an experience to the guests. And part of that is making sure the place looks great, you know, and feels great. And so being willing to get down on your knees and clean some rocks, you know, it was a few hours, you know, but it really set the stage. If you were comfortable doing that and willing to do it, then you were going to pick up the random cigarette butt that you came across on your way into the restaurant and put it in the trash. You were going to, like, do that extra thing to make sure that the place felt as good as the food that tasted.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned people might have this perception that it's below them, or they're there to cook, but in reality, they're there to be part of the team. And the team's responsibility is to create that experience. And you see this even today with, like, some of, like, the big chefs that are doing, like, these sort of crazy, like, I think about, like, Renee and Noma going to Japan. Like, everything is pristine. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if people appreciate the work and sacrifice that goes into doing those little steps that make it great.
And then you take it into your own place or the restaurant that you're working at. I mean, I would be the first one if the dish pit is struggling in there washing dishes. Like, there is no job, you know, I mean, all the jobs, it takes all of us together to create an incredible experience for our guests. And we're all from the, you know, first shrimp that's peeled to the last glass that's polished, like everyone along that chain is a part of creating an incredible atmosphere and experience that we are trying to deliver. And so it's really important, and we all have to be willing to step in and do it. I mean, you know, clean the fryer, mop the floor, like whatever the thing is, it's all got to be done.
There's no one who's above any role in a restaurant. It is truly a team effort. And like, that sometimes means doing things that are uncomfortable and are not necessarily in your normal sort of job description. I want to pivot, and I promise we're not going to end on a low note, but I have to talk about, because I mean, again, your presentation talked about so many things that we talk about in our class. And one of them is failure. And one of them is having to make tough decisions. And I feel like you and I are in a support group because we've both had to close a restaurant at some point. You mentioned that every chef that you know has had to go through some experience like that. I don't know if we necessarily celebrate that the way that it should, because it is a humbling, it is emotional. But I think the most important thing, and I'm curious what your thought is on this, is how to come out of such like a difficult decision and how to turn that struggle into success.
Yes. I mean, when we closed the first restaurant that we closed, I mean, it took us way longer to get to the decision to close it than it should have, because we were hanging on to it because it was shameful. You know, you don't want to be the one who's announcing a failure, quote unquote, you know. But on the other side of it, you know, really, I got more learning out of that experience. I mean, I feel like with Curete, the first restaurant we opened, something just hit, right? And it doesn't always hit. You know, there was just something about the moment and the place and the food and the things and how that all came together that made it successful. I learned far more out of the closing of the restaurant than I did out of opening our first restaurant. And the reason is because all of a sudden I had something to look at and to say, okay, why did this not hit? You know, and to understand that we were missing a clear and concise concept. I mean, that just is the main reason.
It's so amazing. I mean, it gives you perspective, and it allows you to think about, you know, the decisions that weren't right, and then to come out on top. And you've done that. I mean, you've created your second restaurant, which has hit. It's exactly where it needs to be. Give you a chance to talk about that in a second. But you've also gone, you know, in the wake of COVID, into some markets like direct-to-consumer wine, travel experiences, things that people are craving now. Can you talk a little bit about how you launched the second spot and how that sort of has translated into, you know, future ventures?
Well, we opened La Bodega by Curete in the pandemic. First, it started out as a retail shop for getting to-go food, to-go Spanish food, Curete food, to our customers when the restaurants were closed. And then from there, we saw this concept develop of, oh my gosh, we can bring this local spot into Asheville and make it more of a casual kind of all-day dining experience. So there's the retail shop with Spanish specialty goods and baguettes and, you know, pastries and a cafe with coffee. And then upstairs is a full restaurant and wine bar. And it's open all day, every day, you know, except for Mondays. And therefore, we get to serve people like whenever they're kind of walking around the corner. It's to me, it feels like that European, that spot, like you're in a village in Europe and it's your corner spot that you go to get your coffee during the day, your lunch, or your glass of wine at the end of the day. And it feels so wonderful to have that.
It's amazing because you're doing something that so many people demand. Like, people demand, and I teach a course here at the school all about casual food. And I think people demonize casual food. It's not sexy. It's not what, you know, is on the cover of magazines. But the reality is, it's when people wake up in the morning, they want coffee and a pastry. They want something that's open all the time, that's close, that is clean. So, like, a major credit to you for doing that, because I think we need more really, really fantastic chefs to embrace the demand that's out there. So, Katie Button, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Special thanks again to Katie Button for sitting down while she was in Providence for her speaker series. If you're ever in the Asheville area, you must check out her restaurants. They are outstanding. Truly, truly the best Spanish cuisine you can get anywhere. It is unbelievable. Keep an eye on her. She has an awesome cookbook. Check her out on social as well. Special thanks to Matt Burns, who does all the music for the Culinary Now podcast. Please reach out to us at our email, which is culinarynowpodcast@gmail.com, or follow us on social media at Culinary Now Podcast. We love to hear feedback from you, episode ideas, whatever. Your subscription and subscribe hits are really critical to keeping this project alive, so we appreciate all of those and appreciate all of you. We'll talk to you soon.